From Hawaii to Florida, Maine to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Trump administration has rescinded the EPA's endangerment findings, which have added significantly to the cost of vehicles and other products. Derek Morgan of the Heritage Foundation is here with details. President Donald Trump is preparing to deliver the first State of the Union address of his second term. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. During the COVID-19 pandemic, funds were urgently needed, but 5 years later, state and local governments are sitting on billions of unspent dollars. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And Michael Reagan, son of the late President Ronald Reagan, passed away recently. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Endangerment findings relative to greenhouse gases were issued during the Obama administration. The Environmental Protection Agency has now rescinded those regulations. To explain what they are and the impact of the rescission, we turn to Derek Morgan. He is Executive Vice President at the Heritage Foundation. Derek, welcome to American Radio Journal. Derek, when we talk about the endangerment findings that the EPA has had in effect since about 2009, tell us what we mean by endangerment findings. What are they?
From a layman's perspective, essentially Congress passed a bill in the 20th century called the Clean Air Act, and they listed specific pollutants that the Environmental Protection Agency should look at and regulate. And one of those was not the carbon dioxide emission that later was found to be endangered, but fast forward a couple of decades, in the last part of the Bush administration said, we don't think we ought to regulate CO2, greenhouse gases, under the Clean Air Act. It wasn't part of the congressional intent at the time. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court ruled against them. So it was a different Supreme Court than it is now, but a more left-leaning Supreme Court said, no, you have to look at this and make a decision. Either it is or it's not a pollutant. So the time ran out of the Bush administration. President Obama came in. He said, we've looked at this, and yes, it is a pollutant. So that kicked off all kinds of things, including stricter fuel economy regulations and the Clean Power Plan. Now, subsequent courts have said, actually, that Clean Power Plan exceeded your authority. And so right now we're in a season where we're seeing the law changing. And what President Trump has done here is he said, we've taken a fresh look at this. We've looked at the science. We do not believe that CO2 should be regulated under the Clean Air Act. And I think they're on solid ground economically, legally, and scientifically.
Over the years, what has been the impact of the country having to operate under these findings? What sort of challenges, what sort of policies has that put out?
It's been the most expensive regulation in each of the last four presidential administrations has been the fuel economy regulations on cars. And it's raised the price of cars by thousands and thousands of dollars by the government's own estimate, including, by the way, for administrations that were supportive of more stringent economy. They all agree it's raising the price of cars. On the power plant side, President Biden and President Obama before him had the Clean Power Plan, where they were essentially saying, you might remember the famous quote from President Obama, that you could have a coal power plant, but you're going to go bankrupt. So it pushed all of the electricity generation away from coal and onto some more expensive technologies like renewables. So essentially, this one endangerment finding spawned off a bunch of very expensive ways to move us away from affordable traditional fuel sources to so-called green energy that's much more expensive and less reliable.
We are hopefully at the end of a very cold winter, at least in the northeastern part of the country. And Derek, we've really strained a lot of times the energy grid. Have these findings made our energy grid less dependable? And are we at risk of not having the energy supplies that we need going forward, especially with AI and other types of developments taking up a lot more energy?
You're exactly right. The answer to both of those is yes, Loman. So number one, it has made us much less reliable because it's been pushing along with, I should say, in unison with a bunch of tax credits for solar and wind. And they can be okay contributors to our grid. But if you get too high of a percentage relying on those energy sources, you become much less reliable because the wind's not always blowing, the sun's not always shining, and we have nowhere near the battery capacity to smooth that out. So what you end up doing is you end up having to, you build the renewables, and then you have to build up backup plants if you're smart. And we've seen some catastrophic failures of electric grids. Remember Texas a few years ago, for example, in the middle of their very cold winter. And so all of these have contributed to moving away from reliable and affordable sources like coal toward those renewables to such an unhealthy extent. So all of those things combine to really indicate that economically and as a matter of energy purity, this finding was overdue. And you're exactly right about the AI revolution that we're living in the middle of right now. That's going to cause a massive increase in the amount of power needed to fuel these data centers and these AI centers. And we need to have all the energy sources working in as close to a free market as we can so that we can meet that new demand.
And it's vital that we, in fact, build these AI centers, build these data centers and build out the AI platforms, is it not?
It is. We're certainly in a strategic competition with China over this, the kind of race to have the best models and all the rest. And I can be somewhat of a skeptic sometimes on AI, but these models continue to get better and faster and can help in some very important ways in terms of all kinds of things, from robotics that'll be made better with AI to certainly research and things like that. So we very much want to be in the driver's seat there. In order to do that, we have to have secure, reliable, and affordable energy. China's moving in that direction. They are doubling and tripling down on coal. They're really doing all of the above as much as they can. And frankly, unfortunately, they're ahead of us in that regard.
With the rescission of the endangerment findings here, Derek, what impact do you see this having going forward, particularly on the production and cost of automobiles? Everybody, almost everybody has a car, truck, or some similar type of vehicle. Is this going to help keep costs down going forward, maybe even bring some of the costs down?
It's definitely got that potential. So this finding itself just allows the other bad policies. And the president is not only taking a fresh look at the endangerment finding based on more recent science and on solid economics, but he's also looking at the fuel economy regulations. He's essentially lowered those to where the fleets are now. He's also taken his thumb off the scale of the EVs, whereas the previous administration both had many, many tax credits, but they also had California and more than a dozen other states all saying you had to have all EVs just in the next 10 years. So President Trump has said, no, you can't do that. You can't force everybody into an electric vehicle. And these fuel economy regulations are much better thought through. All of that is going to staunch the increase in the cost of cars. And it might even reverse it. And let me tell you how. Right now, or under the old regime, if you were an auto dealer, you had to have a percentage of your sales be electric vehicles. So they would discount some of those models. And you know, surprise, surprise, they weren't the more popular models. And so what they have to do is they have to make up for it by charging more for pickup trucks, SUVs, and the kind of cars that Americans want. So that was increasing artificially the price of these other cars so that they could force people into the EVs. All of that's going to come to a stop pretty soon.
And will this have any impact on getting rid of these annoying stop-start switches? Was that part of this whole process?
That was part of the president's rule. He was very personally annoyed by that, almost as annoyed as he is at what he says is the unsightly nature of giant windmills near his golf courses off the shore and elsewhere. So, yes, those are going to be a thing of the past, except I suppose an auto company could decide they want to reintroduce it. But I think most of us found it to be such a nuisance that I doubt they'll bother.
Well, it was worth the rescission just to get rid of those.
So, that's right.
We have been talking with Derek Morgan, who is Executive Vice President at the Heritage Foundation. And Derek, tell us a little bit about the Heritage Foundation. Where can we find you on the web?
Yeah, you can find us at heritage.org. And we're America's most broadly supported public policy organization in Washington. We have about 500,000 dues-paying members. We've been around for more than 50 years now, and we really see ourselves as America's outpost in Washington, D.C. We're fighting to save the republic, and we're trying to engage everyday Americans to make sure they know what's going on here in Washington.
Derek Morgan of the Heritage Foundation. Derek, thank you so much for taking time.
My pleasure, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the offices of the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on Capitol Hill, where very soon we are going to have President Donald Trump's first State of the Union address of his second term. Scott, good to have you here.
It is my pleasure, Loman. Thank you.
Big night for President Trump, and I'm assuming for messaging for the midterm elections. Your thoughts on where you think the president might go with this address?
Tuesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, we're going to have the president's first State of the Union of the second term. Technically, the big speech that he gave before a joint session of Congress last March was not a State of the Union, but was still a joint session speech. And I think that that was still a pretty memorable speech with all the tributes that he gave to various Americans that have had a unique story to tell. And I think that President Trump is going to lay out his agenda and the things and the promises that he's made and kept. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the impact that that's having on the American people. And he's going to use different stories to talk about the Trump accounts and how a newborn baby now can get $1,000 into a savings account to get them a head start toward financial independence in their future. I think he's going to talk about America being safer and the level of crimes going down. And he's probably going to have some victims there that have been a part of families that have endured really tragic situations. You know, we remember that from the 2025 speech as well. And then I think that he's going to lay out sort of a roadmap for where we're going ahead of the 2026 midterms. The Democrats, they want to be out there and they want to be messaging, and they're going to have their own counter events. I think there's one on the National Mall, and then there's one at the National Press Club. So you're going to see some empty seats on the right-hand side of the Congress when the president is looking out there. But Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader in the House, has said that he'll attend in person because it's the people's house and you can't run him out of his block. But I think the bottom line is, traditionally, you do have most members of the House and Senate, members of the cabinet, members of the Supreme Court, really our leaders in the American government, show up and listen to the president as he makes his case for how strong the country is and where we're headed.
Taking a look at the messaging angle of this, Scott, obviously the economy is something that impacts every single American. And we've seen a lot of very positive economic indicators and statistics over the last few months. We're clearly moving in the right direction. There is concern, however, that at the kitchen table, people are not feeling it. Do you think the president will use this speech as an opportunity to talk more about the economy and maybe less about some of the other issues?
I think it's a great opportunity for him to do that, and I'm glad you asked the question. You know, GDP right now annualized is almost 3%. We've had, I think, three quarters in a row that have been very, very strong, close to 4%. So obviously, the Trump economy is sort of getting back to where it was prior to COVID. And in addition to the tremendous growth that we've seen with GDP, you're also seeing inflation getting pushed down farther and farther. You're seeing the Fed cutting interest rates a few times in 2025. There are economic indicators that things are headed in the right direction. And I think that it's also important to understand that there are key provisions of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that are still getting underway. And those things are going to pay dividends in not just 2026, but over the next 10 years or so, as, you know, businesses have certainty on the tax environment and know that they can grow and reinvest and hire more and increase productivity and increase wages. All those big macroeconomic effects that we want to see through policy are taking shape right now. Now, you're right to point out the fact that there are still kitchen table situations for a disgruntled element of America. People are having a hard time filling up the grocery cart. People are having a hard time with a cold winter and increased costs for electricity and gas. And those are real, real issues. You're talking about the affordability crisis as it pertains to housing, especially for Gen Z. We know that married couples in 2026 at the age of 30, only about 12% of them, 15% of them have home ownership. And, you know, that number two generations ago was over 50%. And so as wages have increased by roughly, let's say, 27% over the last 20 years, what we have not seen is a commensurate increase when it comes to housing affordability. Instead, housing has more than doubled in terms of those costs. And I think as interest rates have gone up from where they were prior to COVID in a really, really good situation for buyers and lenders, right now you're looking at a 7% interest rate, maybe 6.5% if you're lucky. And there's various programs for veterans that I think bring rates even lower. But the question is, how does the national debt impact the steadiness of interest rates in the future? What do people do when it comes to the bond market? I think these are additional questions that President Trump should attempt to answer for the American people, because there's going to be a lot of eyes and ears and a lot of reporting covering this big speech on Tuesday night.
Another major situation relative to the federal government here, Scott. We do have portions of the Department of Homeland Security budget that have not been approved, and the department headed for somewhat of a shutdown here, somewhat of a rolling shutdown. Congress has been out of session this past week, but behind the scenes, any progress?
The congressional leadership from the Democrat side sent the White House a totally unserious proposal that was smacked back down in their face. Listen, I think the Democrats want to see these major reforms to immigration and customs enforcement, so they can tell their radical left base that they're doing everything they can to make sure that deportations stop and that the ICE agents are not out there on the streets arresting people and sending them out of America, these criminals. But the bottom line is America is safer through the activities of the Department of Homeland Security.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, a bit about the club.
Well, we are this organization based out of Washington, D.C., with over 525,000 members from all over America. And our group is united in this idea of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. If you want to learn more about the policies that we advocate for, visit us at clubforgrowth.org, where you can actually sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we enjoy talking with you every week. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
State and local governments are still sitting on billions of COVID-era relief dollars, which in 2020 were described as urgently needed. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details.
I don't want to pat myself too hard on the back, but here's something that I wrote back in March of 2021, in the early days of the Biden administration. I wrote that the federal government was preparing to give states money that they just didn't need. At the time, Congress and the Biden administration were preparing a $350 billion bailout fund for state and local governments, ostensibly meant to help them recover from the pandemic. But as I wrote at the time in that piece, states and local governments were doing pretty fine. They didn't need the spending. And all of that money was likely to be wasted or just pointless. And I gotta tell you, I am feeling pretty vindicated right about now. Hi folks, I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. States and local governments are still sitting on billions of dollars of that emergency COVID relief that they got just about, well, almost 5 years ago at this point. That's according to a new report from the Government Accountability Office that was out just a couple of weeks ago. Now, again, as I said, the Biden administration rolled out that $350 billion bailout for states and local governments. And officials at the time when this was happening back in 2021 were talking a lot about how they were trying to address an urgent need across the country, right? These governments faced significant revenue shortfalls. That's something that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said at the time. She said that they were facing a significant economic fallout from the pandemic. And she went on to say that as a result, these governments have endured unprecedented strains, forcing many to make untenable choices between laying off educators, firefighters, and other frontline workers, or failing to provide services that communities rely on. A few days after she said that, President Joe Biden was urging state and local officials to act quickly. He said that they should spend this money quickly, spend it as soon as you get it, use the funds that we've made available today to prioritize public safety. He went on to say that taking action today is going to save lives tomorrow. Well, states and local governments, by and large, seem to have ignored that instruction to spend the money as quickly as possible, because more than 4 years after the American Rescue Plan passed, state and local governments are still sitting on tens of billions of dollars from that emergency bailout, Once again, that's because of a new report from the Government Accountability Office that shows by March of 2025, states had spent just $156 billion of the $196 billion that they had received. And local governments, meanwhile, had spent about $102 billion out of the $128 billion that they were awarded. There are six states, according to the GAO, New Jersey, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, and West Virginia, that had reported spending less than half of their federal bailout dollars by March of 2025. Now, yes, that was itself almost a year ago. This data is coming a lot slower than we would like. But by that point, it was obvious that state and local governments had not necessarily needed this money because they just hadn't spent it yet, even 4 years after it had been approved by Congress. Some other interesting details in this report, too. It also shows that state and local governments overwhelmingly used their bailout funds basically just to replace lost tax revenue and offset other fiscal costs rather than any sort of thing that might be actually qualified as, you know, public health spending or a direct response to the pandemic. There's one other, I think, interesting wrinkle here that we should note, and that is that funds that are not spent by the end of this year, by the end of 2026, could actually be recovered by the Treasury Department. And the original deadline for spending these funds was actually 2024, but that deadline was quietly extended by the Biden administration shortly before leaving office. So giving states and local governments two extra years to spend this money. Again, money that in theory, at least, was meant to deal with an emergency, meant to deal with a crisis that was hitting states and local governments. I think the fact that so much of that money remains unspent, even years after the pandemic ebbed, really shows that the federal bailout was not necessary, or at the very least was much larger than necessary. And I think that conclusion is further bolstered by some of the other reporting that we've done at Reason and that other people have done looking at how this money was spent. I've talked about this previously on the program here, so we won't rehash it all in detail, but a lot of local governments spent their COVID relief funds propping up things like money-losing government-owned golf courses or funding vanity projects like tourism promotion campaigns. In various places, money from this relief fund was tapped to pay for things like minor league baseball stadium upgrades, renovations to hotels and ski resorts. One city in Rhode Island, I think this is my favorite one, actually. One city in Rhode Island spent $53,000 of its bailout funds on new ergonomic chairs in the city council chambers and a bunch of other updates for city officials in their offices. And of course, there were hundreds of millions of dollars spent by states and local governments all around the country just giving bonuses to government officials. So as we arrive here now on the 6 year anniversary of the beginning of the pandemic, and we arrive now 5 years since the American Rescue Plan was passed, which was the legislation that included this bailout for state and local governments, it is now, I think, undeniable that the bailout of state and local governments was excessive, it was wasteful, and it was driven by this misguided sense of urgency about the seriousness of the fiscal situation that they faced. A fiscal situation that is many times better, of course, than the federal government's own fiscal situation. We are 30-some trillion dollars in debt and adding more every single day. And that, if I can leave you just with one final thought here, is that that ought to be a lesson for federal officials when the next crisis arrives. We don't need another bailout like this. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of this topic and everything else going on around the country this week at Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, reflects on the recent passing of former President Ronald Reagan's son, Michael Reagan, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
I was very saddened to learn of the death of my friend, Michael Reagan, the oldest son of Ronald Reagan. Mike was adopted by Ronald Reagan and Jane Wyman shortly after his birth in March 1945, their second child, with biological daughter Maureen being their first. Though not a biological son of Reagan, Mike was in many ways truly his father's son. He was intimately closer to Ronald Reagan in ideas, thinking, politics, and heart, mind, and soul than any of the other Reagan children, including Ron and Patty, the children of Ronald and Nancy Reagan. Above all, as Mike would often profess, he shared the faith of his father. In fact, as Mike put it, accepting Christ truly saved his life. It was the turning point that not only saved his soul, but his time here on earth. Prior to that, his life had been a mess. When he accepted Christ, he had become adopted a second time, as he put it so eloquently in his gripping memoir titled Twice Adopted. Ronald Reagan adopted me into his family in 1945, Mike told a watching world during the eulogy at his father's funeral in June 2004. I was a chosen one. I was the lucky one. Personally, the first time I talked to Mike Reagan was in September 2003. I interviewed him for my book, God and Ronald Reagan. We talked for probably 2 hours. I recall the phone hurting my ear as I sat in the kitchen typing. When I said to him, "Wow, you have a lot to say," he replied, "Well, you're the first person to interview me about my dad." He lamented that the press and biographers and historians who wanted to talk to the Reagan children often ignored him. They went to more troubled children of his dad and Nancy, like Ron and Patty. The first time I met Mike in person was before a packed audience at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, where I'm a professor. It was February 2007. It was our first annual Ronald Reagan lecture. There was a blizzard that evening, but folks drove from all around to hear Mike talk and laugh and cry about his dad for nearly 2 hours. The place was spellbound. It was special. In fact, the event that evening was so special that we quickly got requests to take the show on the road, which we did. Mike and I did the same thing 2 years later in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where we could have again talked for hours. When the event was finally over and I was pretty much worn out and slumbered off to my hotel room, Mike called me from his room, where I proceeded to join him and our good friend John Gizzi as we talked about his dad, his family, Nancy, the 1980s, who his dad could trust and couldn't trust, the loyalists and the backstabbers, and pretty much everything you can imagine. The three of us must have talked until about 3 a.m. There's so much more that I could say about the man, about Mike Reagan, about my friend, but I think he would want me to end with words that he shared about his dad at his funeral at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley in June 2004. Mike Reagan closed with this. "I was so proud to have the Reagan name and to be Ronald Reagan's son. What a great honor. He gave me a lot of gifts as a child. Gave me a horse, gave me a car, gave me a lot of things. But there's a gift he gave me that I think is wonderful for every father to give every son. The gift that he was going to be with his Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. I can't think of a better gift for a father to give a son. Knowing where he is this very moment, this very day, that he is in heaven, and I can only promise my father this, Dad, when I will go to heaven too. And you and I and my sister Maureen that went before us, we will dance with a heavenly host of angels before the presence of God. We will do it melanoma and Alzheimer's free. Thank you for letting me share my father, Ronald Wilson Reagan," unquote. And for the rest of us, we thank Michael Reagan for his witness, his life, and for what he shared. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengore. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXEX-AM and KGED-AM in Fresno, California, along with KTRU-FM in La Harpe, Kansas. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.